Hello, this is Duncan Steer and welcome to my Radio Days Book Club podcast. This is an edited version of a Zoomcast from earlier in the summer when my guest was Emily Chappell. Emily, as you'll know, is the author of two acclaimed books, What Goes Around, the story of her life as a London cycle courier, and Where There's a Will, the story of her taking part in the transcontinental, the 4,000-kilometre plus unassisted bike race across Europe. We had an audience for the Zoomcast and you will hear some of their questions in the second half of our conversation. Emily talks about becoming an athlete in her 20s, despite not being one of the sporty crowd at school. She talks about the nature of a community of people who might usually identify themselves as loners. She talks about moving on from being a cycle courier, but why she still loves it. And she talks about how cycling as a community can be more actively inclusive of newcomers. Information on upcoming Zoomcasts, podcasts, and maybe even some live theatre events, who knows, is at radiodaysevents.com, or you can write to me at radiodaysevents@gmail.com. In the meantime, I hope you enjoy my conversation with Emily Chappell. I started by asking whether her self-reliance as a long-distance cyclist had helped her to live more comfortably through the long, strange days of the first lockdown.
In a funny way, yes. Not so much the solitude aspect, because actually I have housemates and we've had a surprisingly harmonious sort of joint incarceration. And that's quite novel because I'm used to dealing with things on my own and not having to compromise or listen to other people or anything tiresome like that. I think the things that I've learned from my big rides and races, it's more about the keeping yourself going and how you do that, because it's been quite hard in lots of ways. And for me, the first 2 months, I think, were the really difficult bit. And because I didn't have anything to do except go out for a short bike ride now and then, you know, all my work had dried up. I had 2 months of free time, which in some ways is quite nice, but in some ways gives you a lot of time to contemplate your own everything. And that's a bit like races. You know, if you're riding along for 20 hours a day, you've got a lot of time to go over everything you might or might not want to go over. So you do learn to rein yourself in at times. So one of the things I discovered, it sort of became one of my techniques, was when I was doing the big sort of multi-day, multi-week ultra endurance races, was really to pay attention to my own kind of habits and rhythms and how I worked. So I've got a very definite daily structure. I don't know if everybody would, but I have very good energy first thing in the morning, and then sometime after lunch, mid-afternoon, I have a period of feeling absolutely awful, and that's when the demons get me, and that's when I'll ride along thinking, oh, this is terrible, why am I doing this, I'm no good at this, I don't even like bikes, I'm failing, it's a disaster, I'm awful. And you know, and you've got plenty of time and space to turn that into a really effective downward spiral. And then of course, when you're, you know, exhausted and ill and verging on injury, it goes badly. You start to look for reasons to quit and ways to beat yourself up, and it all starts to look quite bleak. So I learned to catch myself when I was doing that and to recognize, okay, in the afternoon, I'm going to feel rubbish, hate myself a little bit more, and I'm going to slow down. It's going to feel much harder. I will feel less fit, and that's never fun. Mm. Also, it's the hottest part of the day. That's no coincidence. So I would remind myself at that point, okay, slow down. You are going to feel pathetic for the next 3 hours, so just ride in a pathetic fashion, but keep riding. Remember that you felt good for 5 hours this morning, and remember that you always feel good when it gets dark and, you know, it cools down and the night starts to happen. And I've translated quite a lot of that to this, like knowing that when you go through a bad patch, it will end. And when you go through a good patch, it will end too. So make the most of it, get some stuff done and build up some, you know, ways of feeling good about yourself, and just accept that you're going to have all of these fluctuations, which I think a lot of people have had in a lot of different ways. I think one of the things about lockdown that contrasts with the races is that we're all in it together, but we're all having very different experiences. Or not all of us, but you know, we can be divided into a few different groups. So my experience was having absolutely nothing to do, no work, no earning, but also, you know, free time and feeling completely useless, you know, having all of this time and energy and just not having anywhere to put it. And then my sister, who, you know, she and her husband both have jobs, they have children. They were working, I think, effectively four full-time jobs between two people in a very tiny house. So their experience and their difficulties were very different. And in a race, you generally know that someone else is having the same experience somewhere just the other side of the mountain range or up the road somewhere. And here, we sort of both did and we didn't. You know, we're all in it together, but what we're going through varies a bit more.
You see, I have said, I said on the Carlton Kirby Zoomcast that you had been my best guest.
Oh.
He took it all right. I mean, you know, he looked a bit grumpy about it. But this, you see, I see there's a kind of, I don't want this to be awkward, but there's a kind of wisdom that you get from what you've done with your physical challenges. And it's like you sort of, you take what you've learned from your body being tested, and you, as you've just shown. And in some, when we did these events, sometimes people ask you a very kind of technical kind of cycling question at the end. And I kind of, please do that, by the way. Please ask a technical cycling question. Don't let me preempt it.
We'll have to give you an underwhelming answer.
we'll chat about 10 to 9 and then we'll have a little break and then you can ask some questions afterwards, viewers. But I want to say, no, ask her something kind of philosophical and something about the nature of life and sort of emotional endurance. And that's, this isn't leading anywhere, this question. But we're going to talk about the book in a minute, but let's talk a little bit about the reaction to the book. You've been doing, I mean, I suppose one thing that occurs to me is the books, both books, I love the What Goes Around, which is the story of your life as a London cycle courier. But both books are very inwards and very introspective, and you kind of getting to know your emotions and your body and, you know, very inward. And then I see that when you're promoting your book and you're on Twitter, maybe sort of speaking up for campaigns, you have to be more social, you have to be a joiner, you know, you have to, do you see that as two sides of you, or are you more reluctant to be one than the other?
Well, that's actually, it's a very tricky question.
Very long question.
Well, it's going to be a very long answer. I think,
great.
I mean, it boils down to, yes, both. It's a complicated balance. So I think I spend probably 90% of my time alone, and I really love it, which I worry is very kind of self-obsessed. And but also, I think there's a certain self-effacement to being alone. You know, I for example, when I'm cycling, when I'm on my own, I stop worrying about all the things you worry about, how you come across, you know, what shape your body is, all the rest of it. I just become kind of an outlook hurtling down the road. And I feel as though all the stuff that is me in the world is kind of moved out of the way, and I can just see the world without me getting in the way. Mm. I mean, you know, I'm seeing it from my perspective still, but there's that. And I've always traveled alone, initially because I just had no friends who would come with me. And then because it was a choice, because I really prefer it that way. I have noticed on, you know, I've done long trips, and occasionally you meet another cyclist and you ride with them for a few days, which is in many ways really wonderful. But I noticed almost every time the world would kind of take a step back. Because when you're with someone else, you're part of a group, you're less open. And so that, I think, kind of explains why I really, really love doing this all alone. I just think you experience it that much more when you're on your own. But I think also I always have to, like, I think I'm an introvert, but I have to put a lot of caveats in there. Because I'm also really sociable. I love people. I love chatting. I really love doing events like this. You know, I know there are all these people here behind the screen. I can't see them, but hello. And I love being part of communities. One of the things that's blown me away over the last few years, so at the moment I'm doing a campaign with Rafa for the Women's 100, and the idea behind the campaign is one I've had for a few years, which is the Invisible Peloton, which is all of the people that you have with you when, not, you know, virtually, when you're on the road, when it's hard, when it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon and you can't be bothered, or there's a really big hill to get up, and you reach out to these people to, you know, to give you inspiration or to give you strength or just to distract you. And it might even be non-cyclists. You know, I think about my mum sometimes, who is not really a cyclist at all. And I didn't cycle with other people, especially not other women, till about 5 years ago. And I didn't really think there were any women in the world who were like me, who would want to do these really absurd big rides and suffer a bit and not sleep and, you know, get a bit dirty. And the first one I met was Juliana Boring. I mean, we rode together 5 years ago. And since then, there's loads and loads. And now, like, half my social circle seems to be women and quite a few men, because they do also ride bikes, who do these incredible big rides. I'm still just, I keep saying blown away, but I really am. I just, the more I think about it, the more I think, well, where did they all come from? It used to feel like it was only me. And now I'm part of this incredible world. And there's all these people I know who do these amazing things. So, yeah, that's my long-winded way of saying yes, both.
Yeah.
I think something I've noticed, there's Audaxes in the comments. I'm actually, I'm fanning myself with the Audax magazine. One of the things I really love about...
Never off duty.
One of the things I love about riding Audaxes is that you can be on your own for the entire ride, but you've got this kind of nebulous fellowship around you. You know, you will pass people or they'll pass you, and there's just a bit of a nod. But the nod means so much more. It's just that kind of, hello, you're like me, I'm like you, we're doing the same thing. I understand that you don't really want to talk to me. I don't want to talk to you either, but it's great to see you. And then, you know, you'll see people in cafes and have a really nice cup of coffee together and then set off a tactical 10 minutes apart. And it's, I love that I have so many friends who are also loners.
That's so great, isn't it? That the community of people who don't really want to talk to each other. I mean, that's a thing, isn't it? It's a head spinning thing. We should read Kate's comment. She's an Audax rider, currently being treated for breast cancer. I mean, I don't know if everyone's got chat up, put chat up, you can read them yourself. Emily's chapter in Ride Like the Wind, riding up Mont Ventoux at midnight, has kept me going on my cancer triathlon with chemotherapy. I have an invisible peloton behind me. Wow. Thank you, Kate.
I'm in it if you want me, Kate.
That's great. So you kind of brought an invisible peloton into being. These are people who you kind of hoped and imagined would exist, and then you've met them. And then beyond that, you have other inspirations, writers maybe, or is that? I mean, because you're an English graduate, aren't you? So are your heroes before this? Were your heroes writers, musicians? Who were your kind of role models before?
Interesting question. It could be that I've just forgotten, but when I think about having heroes, it always was people like, well, Dervla Murphy is the original one. I was into her before I did this. And she was sort of sitting at the back of my mind as this aspirational figure I hadn't quite yet realised I aspired to. And I don't know. I mean, I have, obviously there are loads and loads of writers who are heroes and favourites of mine. But I think the people in the invisible peloton are usually cyclists, occasionally other athletes.
We talked when we chatted the other day. You mentioned GB Giro that's been going on. Mm-hmm. I think has it finished? It's finished for some people.
Yeah,
finished for everybody. I don't know.
I think the second to last person has just finished. If I'm not mistaken, I've not checked it today because I've been at work, but. Yeah, it's been amazing. It's kind of reignited some of my excitement about racing. I wasn't even sure. I think most people weren't sure if it was even a good idea. So for those who aren't in the know, maybe everyone's in the know, but just in case, GB Giro is a predominantly off-road self-supported race from Land's End to John O'Groats. So the length of the United Kingdom, and it's something like 2,000 kilometres. And this year, because of the current situation, they decided that for reasons of safety and social responsibility, they couldn't have riders, you know, going into petrol stations every 20 miles up and down the country to get snacks and handing out the virus as they went. So they decreed that the ride had to be completed not only self-supported, but self-sufficient. So riders had to carry everything they would need and find water en route. And they were not allowed to acquire or deposit anything during the course of the race. Which is just, it kind of takes it into another league. But I think for me, there's also these more subtle things of how it must affect the race experience. And I went out to see some of the races because they came quite close to where I live. And most of them were not in the mood for very long philosophical chats, so I'll catch them a bit later. But for me, a big part of long distance rides and races is the encounters. I mean, it's the food. I really love sitting around in cafes and stations and bombing around Lidl every 2 hours.
2 hours?
Well, you're riding through the Balkans, you're going to find a Lidl every 2 to 3 hours. And if you're really going for it, you'd be hungry. And I had a couple of very nice days in Croatia where I just went to every single Lidl. It was great. Lidl is a place of great joy and comfort for me when I'm
What do you recommend in the Croatian Lidl? Have they got a different range of pastries or something?
Yeah, pastries are different. Every Lidl... do you want to get me talking about Lidl? Because I have quite a lot to say.
Do it for a bit and then we'll draw a curtain. We'll see how it goes.
The great thing about Lidl when you're in a long distance bikepacking event is that it's fairly simple, you know, low quantities of stock. So it's not too confusing. It's not like going into one of those massive French supermarkets, which are amazing. They're like the British Museum, but you can spend hours in there. Lidl is great, you know, does the job. They have, for the most part, everything is the same, whatever country you're in. And they're laid out exactly the same. So once you've done it a few times, you can get around really quickly because you just go in, you know, right, pastries are over there, cherry tomatoes are there, go up the end, you've got pepperoni and you've got orange juice and yogurt drink there, pick up some cheese over there and then down the aisle, pick some chocolate on your way to the till, start drinking the juice in the checkout and you're out. I can do it very, very quickly now. The pastries do vary, but once you're into a new country, first couple of trips into Lidl, you might, you know, you'll experiment a bit. You quickly figure out the ones you like. Because I think when you're travelling that far, that quickly, you actually do need some sense of stability. You're seeing so many new things. You often don't know what's around the next corner. The world is constantly surprising you and you're constantly on alert. You actually want something that is the same every time. So I would get quite upset if somebody moved the cheese or something and, you know, much more upset than you would be if you couldn't find a thing in a supermarket, because that was where I was pinning my sense of, you know, my need for stability.
So for you, the difference between, say, the Transcontinental and the GB Duro, that's almost, what is that? That's like an emotional regularity you're missing. It's not something that you would find physically harder to do in terms of the concept of it, but it's more of a sort of mental adjustment.
I would find it much physically harder. I mean, it's right. Very off-roady and it looked brutal, and obviously the bike will be a lot heavier because you have all of your food on it. So I think people are coming out of it saying this is the hardest thing I've done, and there are people in it who have ridden the Transcontinental and many other things, and I'm really excited to read all the, you know, the race reports that come out of it, because I really want to see what people's experience has been. But I think the difference will be you'll have less of that kind of serendipitous discovery of, you know, Croatian pastries or whatever else, or lovely little moments in cafes. I think people have gone out like I did to meet the racers, so there will be a few encounters and things. But also I've been thinking a lot over the last few years, and it's really ramped up in the last few months, about the responsibility of travelling and how we travel, where we travel and who we travel among. And this is something with my past travels, when I think back now, I'm more and more ashamed of how wrong I got it. So the best example to illustrate this is in 2012, I cycled through, well, I didn't cycle all the way, I was partly in a police jeep, but I went through Balochistan, which is the area in southern Pakistan. It's kind of where Iran, Afghanistan and Pakistan meet. And it's a very dangerous area for a number of reasons, which I won't go into, for reasons of time mainly. And I did think very carefully and do a lot of research and decided to go through, and was given a police escort, was given a bodyguard at one point. I had a great time. Everybody was very nice to me. I was well looked after. They seemed to enjoy having me around, and it was a very good experience. Mm. And I didn't know how close I might have been that close to being kidnapped at one point. It might have been absolutely fine. I had no sense, and you don't always know if you're in danger or not. A year later, a Spanish touring cyclist was on the news because he had been cycling through this area, and he and his escort had been ambushed. And he was okay, he was absolutely fine, but some of the people who were protecting him had been shot, and I had this terrible, terrible guilt, because in my naivety, it hadn't even occurred to me that all these really friendly, charming policemen and people I'd stayed with were in danger because of my presence. And that's the most stark example I can think of. But now, you coming to the other end of the time frame, now when we travel, we are at risk of spreading disease or bringing disease home and, you know, infecting vulnerable people. And I think I've more or less put myself on a travel ban this year. I'm not going abroad. I don't know how safe it is, and even when it feels safe, I worry that if I went, I would then find out in hindsight it wasn't. And I think for me, I'm not doing it. And I'm quite heartened by how a lot of these races are really starting to interrogate themselves. And I mean, before the pandemic even hit, GB Giro had said, we are now a no-fly event. You're not allowed to fly to get here. We won't have anyone, you know, flying in from South Africa or whatever. So there was one guy who rode it just now, who cycled from Andorra to the start of the race, because he had to come over land. And that is, you know, I applaud that massively. And they've also upped the ante with this self-sufficient thing. And then in a different way, there's in October, there's a race in Italy called the Two Volcanoes Sprint. And they are encouraging people to come to the area because the areas that they're riding through are very, you know, the tourist industry is huge there. People's living has been decimated, and the race, it's a non-profit, and it's working in partnership with local mayors and local businesses along the way, and trying to run it in sympathy with local people and raise money to support initiatives to help them into the future. And it's it's something I quite like, because the discipline of ultra racing has, you know, it's less than a decade old, really, this sort of racing. And it's starting to grow up and mature in all sorts of ways. It's becoming more professionalized, which I think is both a good and a bad thing. I didn't really anticipate this new kind of moral strand to it, but I really like it.
Yeah, like next level. Let's start now. Let's start the event. We're here to talk about Where There's a Will by Emily Chappell. Well, because I guess everyone's read it. Write in if you haven't. You can buy it, actually. We're doing a special offer. I should look straight to camera. Special offer. Where you put on the Ticket Tailor page, and you get a discount for having come to the meeting. And also for What Goes Around, which... how do the book sales compare? I'm thinking maybe Where There's a Will has sold more than What Goes Around. Would I be right?
I don't know.
Okay.
Every now and then I get told, and it's a number. It's surprising how little it means to me. I think if it were, you know, millions and millions, and I was very, you know, a bestseller, maybe it would. Maybe if I was on a bestseller list, I'd be thinking, come on, sell more.
Charts, like the charts. Up to number three. It'd be amazing, wouldn't it? But I must say, they're both great books. But so this is built around Emily. Now, I put on an advert somewhere, Emily winning the Transcontinental, and some sniffy fella wrote in, you were the first woman over the line. It's 4,000 kilometres in 13 days, I think. Yeah. And as I've already alluded...
Well, the pedants among us will probably point out, it was 13 days, 10 hours and 28 minutes.
So how do you round that down? Do you round that down? I'm rounding it down. That's fair, isn't it?
No. Accuracy.
Round it up. So, and it's built around that. But as we've already alluded to, it's very internal, and it's kind of, you know, your own kind of emotional journey, your own inward journey, and as you're going around. I mean, it would have been different to write this book in a completely different way, covering the same facts, wouldn't it? But this what goes around similar style, very introspective, but kind of showing you parts of London and kind of working life that you won't have seen. Viewers, because Emily's a cycle courier and she's kind of on the fringes of society. In fact, both of these are about being a little bit on the fringes of society. I think before I compared it to George Orwell, but is that something that you kind of, is that a thread in your writing that you were just kind of like on the edges, like observing stuff that is, you know?
I think this goes back to your question about what I will call the introvert extrovert question. I think as a writer, probably I am on the fringes because it just works better. If you're observing and writing about the world, you kind of have to sit in the corner with your pencil rather than being part of it, because then you're busy. And even if you were part of it in the thing you're writing about, you then have to go back to your room and type it up. So I think maybe it's just the way things come across when you write them. Like, you know, you're standing there, you're describing the thing that's before you. What was the other half of the thing I was going to say?
I will say, I'm conscious not to interrupt. I'm a terrible interrupter. Please don't be frustrated with me. I can't help it. But what I was going to say was, it's just very personal. It's like your diary. I mean, obviously, there's talk about relationships. Of course, there's a bereavement at the centre, I would say, of where there's a will. It's very personal. You don't have any...
It's raining.
Now we've got an event. I can't relax. Emily Chappell can relax. But it's very personal. It's very kind of soul bearing. Or do you not see it like that? Do you think you're kind of speaking for everyone because everyone feels like this? So why should you be embarrassed?
Well, yeah. I would hope that everybody has at least something in common with some of the stuff I've described. I don't know if I'm embarrassed, actually. I often worry a bit when I'm going to share something that seems quite personal. But every time I've done it, a lot or a few people have come back and said, oh, my goodness, I experienced something like this. And, you know, you have put your finger on it, or you have helped, or just, you know, here's my story. So it seems to be useful in some way. And also that does help me to sort of connect with the world a bit and think, wow, all these very weird personal experiences perhaps were not that weird.
Yeah.
So that sort of helps. I think the other thing I was going to say is I am sometimes the person in the corner with the pencil, but then in my extrovert side of life, you know, the sociable side, I'm often someone who kind of, I don't know, gets impatient and says, right, come on, everyone, we need to sort this out and change the world, and, you know, becomes quite central trying to make that happen with varying degrees of success. So I think there's both sides, and I'd like to say I have a balance. In reality, I think I swing between them in quite a chaotic way.
The inspirational thing, maybe, most inspirational thing about this, is that you kind of state quite clearly that you weren't sporty when you were younger. You know, this is something that's kind of come upon you relatively late in life, certainly older than, you know, if you were going to be in the Tour de France, you've probably been riding races since you were 9 or something, or any kind of top level sport. And yet here you are, you're doing something that is, it's right up there. But you've only really started it relatively late in life. And I think that's particularly inspirational for a lot of readers. Please write in and say, if you agree with me, viewers, but maybe you could speak a little bit to that and how you were at school. What are girls not encouraged to do sport? Is there something that puts them off? I mean, I know there is, your relationship with athleticism, if you want.
I think it's a lot of what I have to say is the very typical story of I was kind of okay at sport as when I was a child, nothing special, nothing remarkable. Then when I was a teenager, I did what most teenage girls do and just completely stopped doing any form of exercise. I think because of probably self-consciousness, body issues, peer pressure. And there was a social divide. I think if you were one of the cool, popular people, you were good at sport. And if you weren't, even if you kind of wanted to do sport, you weren't really welcome. So as well as not being sporty and being a bit chubby and being self-conscious. On the occasions where, you know, sometimes I was good at high jump, for example, and once or twice I, you know, in high jump season, I do a bit of that and I go to athletics meetings and never have a very good time because I wasn't, the gang who did that didn't really want to have me around and I was just sitting in the corner reading a book in between events and they thought I was weird and I thought they were weird. So it kind of didn't work. And I always, although I think it's in some ways, it's quite a cliched story. I want to keep telling people that I didn't get into this till I was in my mid-20s and I was a fat kid at school and probably most people who were at school with me would look at me now and think, she turned out to be an athlete. She's the last person, I think, because there are so many people who kind of feel like, you know, their day is done by the time they're grown up. Like, you know, I've never been into sport, it's too late to get into it now. And I got into it well into adulthood and it changed me completely. Like I still, inside I'm still the awkward teenager and I sometimes look at myself and think, hang on, what on earth have you turned into? You are, you know, I struggle to call myself an athlete because not what I expected.
I think you are an athlete. What are you doing? I love that. Your internal voice is going, what are you doing? Going up a mountain? What are you doing now? Sit still. But I do think that is maybe the most inspirational thing. And I think a lot of sport, they have a vested interest to say that you have to start playing tennis when you're three. So the coaches can, you know, can start charging your parents. And the idea that you might get to a decent standard and you start when you're 25 or something. I think a lot of sports are quite exclusive of that idea. But have you found, so you talk about when you first started Audax, and I've got a note here. I mean, it's a community of, obviously Kate has written in here, but it's a community that may be characterised as being men and older men. And so have you found the sport you've gone into welcoming right from the start, or have you had to kind of earn your spurs?
I think basically, yes, it has been welcoming. It's never really been unwelcoming. One or two instances, but generally, Audax has always been welcoming. I think the main thing is sometimes, now Audax, there's a lot more women doing it and a lot more young women, but even 5 years ago, I'd turn up to events and it would just be a lot of old men and me. And there was no facility, but I think they didn't really know what to make of me and I didn't really know what to make of them. But it was fine because I didn't want to talk to them and they didn't want to talk to me. It's not social. So Audax was more comfortable because you can just keep yourself to yourself if you want to. Like, there's ample opportunity to socialise, but it's sort of understood if you don't want to or if you don't want to right now. And I was going to say something as well about... you know, you were talking about getting into tennis when you're three and, you know, you should start cycling when you're nine if you want to make it as a pro. I had very, very brief, fleeting regrets when I was in my late 20s and I'd realised I was quite into cycling. And a couple of friends were like, you should be in the Olympics because, you know, they thought I was really great. I leagues below the Olympics, but they weren't to know that. And I thought, oh, isn't it a shame that I didn't have a dad like Nicole Cooks? Because she's my age and, you know, by the time I got into cycling, she'd already won the Tour de France. And, you know, I watched her ride in the Olympics and thought, well, you know, I could have been there if I'd had a different childhood. Now, I am so glad and grateful I never went down that path. You know, I never had the opportunity to, but I'm glad I didn't. I'm glad it didn't happen because I don't think professional competitive cycling is a healthy place to be. It certainly works for some people. I think it definitely would not be for me. So either I would have not got on with it and stormed off, or it would have broken me. It might have killed my love for cycling. And I found other ways to do it and other ways to, I don't want to say excel in it because it's not about excelling, other ways to explore it to its utmost and push myself further than I thought I'd ever go and see what's on the other side. And I find that a lot more exciting than I think I would have the more traditional route.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's your mission, isn't it? It's not your dad's mission or your kind of junior coach's mission. And I mean, you see some of the stuff that comes out about cycling and obviously gymnastics, but Olympic sports where young kids are kind of have some talents I'm not going to start doing a speech, but you know, there's a certain relationship, and it becomes it, th their joy is turned into a chore by adults who want them to, you know, perfect it. Whereas your
Or
mission is your mission.
their own ambition still. I mean, you know, if I'd gone into pro cycling with the ambition of, well, I don't, whatever my ambition would be, like being world champion, I would torture myself trying to get there. And then if it ever came to the stage where I had to make a decision to keep going with it or decide whether, you know, back in the bad days, I'd have had to decide whether or not I was going to take drugs or never win a race, it would have killed me. You know, all of the pressure from myself and then feeding that into a machine. I mean, I don't really have that much of a downer on pro cycling. I think it's more that I suddenly realize, oh, it's actually that really wouldn't have been for me. I'm so glad I found this thing that really is.
Well, we had Jonathan Vaughters, former US postal teammate of Lance Armstrong, did one of these events.
Really? I didn't know that.
I didn't host it. Jeremy Whittle hosted it, but I did all the work. But in it, Jonathan said this tremendously memorable phrase. He said when he joined the US postal team, and he was very innocent, and it was clear that he was going to have to take drugs. He said, "I had the choice between smashing my moral compass or smashing my dreams." I
Ooh.
thought, wow, there you go. That's that, isn't it? Like, so it's either if you want to be in the Tour de France and be in the winning team, you have to do this or leave. And I thought, wow, that's pretty. He sounded pretty fed up when he said that, I've got to say. It was dark. Anyway, there's more things I want to talk about. I want to talk about Le Loup, which obviously can't happen this year. Perhaps we should talk about that, and then maybe in the second half we can talk about, because we want to talk about cycling and its inclusivity or lack thereof, and you know, Black Lives Matter, LGBT. It sounds like it's going to be a punchy second half, but there's a lot of issues to discuss there, isn't there, about the kind of what we can do to be more inclusive. But let's talk a bit about the loop, which is how many times you've done it. You've done it a couple of times,
I think this would have been my third year doing the full thing.
right? So this is sorry, you.
So yeah, Le Loup is it's one of those things where you think, right, to describe it in one sentence, I've got to get all the constituent elements in. So it's a charity bike ride that follows every single stage of the Tour de France full length 1 week before the pros do. So, you know, if they're riding 215K next Saturday, we're doing it this Saturday. We follow the route as closely as we can. We can't go down motorways and one-way streets, but apart from that. And to my absolute joy, it's fully supported. So it's kind of, in some ways, the riding is actually harder than doing the Transcon. It's often more mountainous. But we have a full team of mechanics, of physiotherapists, of drivers, and very, very brainy, organized people who make it all happen. We stay in nice hotels. We sometimes don't get there till about 10 at night, but they are nice briefly. And we see so much of France. One of the things I've learned from Le Loup, I tend to recce about two-thirds of the route in May, and then we do the ride in July. So certain bits that I get to know quite well. The Tour de France route is actually very, very good for cycling. I had always assumed that there'd be a lot of really boring roads that look good from a helicopter, but I've discovered so many excellent roads in France that I will be going back to for the rest of my life. They really do a good job with the route. There's like last year there was one 40K section that was rubbish in, well, you know, 3,000 plus kilometers. Apart from,
What was rubbish about it?
oh, it was a busy stretch of road in a fairly
Right.
built up area with hills and fumes and, you know, Lidls that we weren't stopping in. And you know, you see a lot more of that sort of thing on most rides. This was a really, really well-planned route. But one of the other very novel things for me is that Le Loup, we have a lot of people with us. So about 50 people are with us for the whole 3 weeks. And then a lot of other people come in to do the first half or the second half or the Alps or a bit in the middle. So I get to ride with so many different people. And of course, this is probably the hardest, or one of the hardest things you can do as an amateur cyclist. that's not a race, let's say. It really is. You know, people do the étape every year, which is one stage of the Tour de France. And that is one of the big challenges. And not to denigrate anyone who's ever done l'étape, because it is very hard. But I'm blown away that people come to do multiple Tour de France stages, multiple back-to-back mountain stages. And the atmosphere is incredible, because everyone bonds, obviously. We're all going through this extremely difficult but also extremely joyful thing together. So we share the highs and the lows. You know, within the first few days, everybody has made friends. And there's all these wonderful, you know, people help each other up the climbs. And I could tell you about a million stories about it, but just one from last year. So 2 years ago, there was a gentleman called Andy who came to do, I think, just the mountains. And I don't think he'd done anything like that before. He'd really trained up, and it was kind of towards the limit of what he was capable of, but he did it. And going up the Tourmalet, he had one of those, like, it was a very hard climb, and he almost didn't get through it. But one of the team doctors was riding with him and, you know, helped him up the mountain, and he thanked her afterwards. The following year, last year, going up the Planche des Belles Filles, he was that person for another rider. He was back to do the whole thing, and he smashed it. And at the end of the day, this other cyclist said, I wouldn't have got up that mountain if it wasn't for Andy. He stayed with me, he helped me, he distracted me, he was there. And that's just, for me, that story encapsulates everything that's amazing about Le Loup and how we get through it.
Yeah, so that group of 50 people, they get through it. I mean, because of course you know on paper how much training that will probably need, but it is the Tour de France route. You must have quite a lot of people who get like 5 or 10 or 15 days in and think, I'm not sure this was for me. I mean, it's not, because they won't have done anything exactly like that before, or have they? I don't know.
Most people finish it. I think every year, you know, that there will always be one or two people who have an unforeseen injury or something. But no, people get stronger. That's the magical thing.
Yeah.
I warn people at the start, like, if you go off like you're, you know, sprinting on the Champs-Élysées, and if you ride outside of your capacity, you'll just get weaker and weaker because you won't be able to recover in the, you know, the short sleeps you get. But if you ride within your capacity, you will actually get stronger as you get into the ride. And I think it was stage 8 last year, several riders came up to me on that particular day and said, I can't believe it, I'm feeling stronger, I feel really good today, we haven't even had a rest day yet. And I was like, yes, of course you don't. So it's fun to watch people go through that process as well.
Let's do some of these questions then. That was good chit chat though, wasn't it? I thought that was quite high value chit chat. this is Robert Oliver. What does Emily miss the most about being a cycle career?
I can't really, the big cheesy grin on my face is because I just miss being a cycle career. I miss it so much. They were really happy years. It's very hard to think of one thing that I miss. It's just little things like really actively looking forward to Monday morning, because I do 5 days a week, spend most of the weekend sleeping, eating, and just, you know, having a nice time and resting. And by Monday morning, I'd be like, yes, I get to go and ride my bike again while everyone else goes to work. It was great. And then I miss how much I enjoyed my dinner every night. Which I have also had touring, and generally with cycling, like, it increases your enjoyment of food because you get so hungry. But I could eat the most boring pasta and pesto and genuinely want to text my friends and tell them how good it was. And, you know, how great my bed felt when I got into it. And it was as if when you're a courier, you turn up the volume on all the basic pleasures in life, and you don't need anything else. Like, you don't need to take class A drugs or, you know, go shopping a lot or any of the things people do to make themselves happy, because you just, you know, you finish your day at work, you have a hot shower, eat some pasta.
It's so great. You make yourself thirsty, then you have a drink, and it's brilliant. That's it. You make yourself hungry, then you eat some food. What a way to live.
It really is. It really is.
Could you not go back to it, because it is something, I don't know if you actually say this in your book, it may be implied, there's some people who do it like I don't know, into their 40s, lifers,
Oh, into their
but it's kind of
50s.
a, yeah,
There's
but you
people
couldn't,
who are.
you wouldn't go back.
No. And partly that feels like a limitation I've put on myself because I think, I don't want to say if you do it for too long, you kind of, you shrivel and wilt, because some people have very successfully done it for years. But I think I did it for way longer than I expected. And everyone was always like, oh, you've got to get out of this. It's a dead end job. Someone with your talent should be doing other things. And I just continued to love it for years and really didn't want to quit. But now I think I have reached the end of the road with careering. I think I often use this analogy. It's like getting to the end of a relationship with someone who is really great. And ultimately, you both need to move on. But there's so many things about them that are wonderful. They're not a bad person. You haven't fallen out, and you will look back with real fondness, and you just wish them well. And you'll go on and live your life, and they'll go on and live theirs. And I think it's like that. And also, the world of careering, I think, has changed a lot now. It wouldn't be the same if I went back.
No, it's I love it. I love this book. It's a whole world that obviously I've seen, but I've not been in. And I love it. I commend it to you. Why don't you buy it from our website? That would be good. Well, when did you, this is from Marcia. When did you first know you loved long distance riding? What was the first one?
I don't know what the first one was. It sort of depends on what we define as long distance. the first quite big ride I did was just after I got into cycling. So it would have been early 2006, and it was a ride down to Brighton. It was an overnight ride with some people I knew. And that's, I guess, 60 miles from London. Sorry, that's where I lived at the time. And that was special because my father had done the British Heart Foundation London to Brighton ride in 1984. And it had, and still has, become part of his personal mythology. So if you ever meet my father, get him talking about Ditchling Beacon in 1984. It's a well-turned story now, and he was at his peak physically, mentally, spiritually, and he passed all these people, and he could see the sweat coming out the back of his hands, and I know that glee. And so when I got to the top of Ditchling Beacon, at the early hours of the morning, I remember texting him and saying, the eagle has landed, and that felt like quite a moment. And then it's very hard to say. So I very quickly got into doing big long rides. And I think a couple of months after that I did my first 100 miler. I've done many more. I've done quite a lot of them solo. There was one in, it would have been 2014. So this was just after the Transcontinental had started. That was the previous year. The Trans Am bike race had happened not so long before. And I did the Dunwich Dynamo, which I'd done before. It's a 200-kilometer overnight ride from London to the Suffolk coast. And then I rode back, more or less without stopping. And that was a 400-kilometer ride, so 250 miles. And I did have one of those little moments of, oh my goodness, I didn't realize I could do that thing I just did. Maybe I'm a different person. Maybe I am capable of some more things. And that was when the idea woke up in my mind a bit of maybe I could do something like the Transcontinental. And then all the other voices said, no, someone like you, no, goodness, you're nowhere near good enough. But that was a seminal ride, and that was one where, I don't know, as probably anyone who's read my books will know, I spend quite a lot of time doubting myself and putting myself down. But every now and then I think, ah, well, that was quite good actually. And that was one of those little moments.
I've seen you talk somewhere, maybe it was at one of our events. I don't think it's in the books, but about what cycling means to women, you know, what the positive things. I think you say it's freedom for women. I can't think what you say it is for men, but it's something. Can you remember? Do you remember this phrase? Did you just say it once, or is it written
Oh,
down
I
somewhere?
think I do know what you might be talking about. Correct me if I'm wrong. This was something that it came up. It was in an interview that was for the Telegraph. I don't know if it made it into the final interview. And I think it's actually probably quite a controversial thing to say, because I think a lot of people will not share the experience, but yeah. The interviewer and I were talking, and we sort of came up together with this idea that for so many women, cycling means freedom. I've literally asked a lot of people when I've interviewed them, you know, what does cycling give you? And they kind of boringly all just say freedom. So, right, okay, fine. I feel that too. And then we were talking about this whole slightly now dated narrative of cycling being about pain.
Yes, this is it. Yeah.
So it's a comment I want to partially disown, because I do think it's more complex than that. And quite a lot of men have now said, actually, no, for me, it's freedom as well. So, but let's debate it. So what we decided was, I think because of the way life often works out for men and for women and the difference of experiences and responsibilities they have, men need to find some sort of, you know, agreeable difficulty that doesn't exist in their life. Whereas women deal with quite a lot of pain and difficulty in the normal course of their life. And I've actually just read a book. I don't have it about me. Anyway, I've just read a book all about the female experience of pain, and how women suffer more pain in general, suffer it differently, and all the medical reasons behind that is quite interesting. Which I think, you know, again, to generalise spuriously, might mean that women are just less interested in embracing more pain. They want
I think I think this is a brilliant discussion. I know you're distancing yourself from its main findings, but I think that's okay. Because I think then there is a notion a little bit around, and not just endurance sports, but sports in general, that, you know, yes, men's lives are quite comfortable, and it's a kind of way of bringing back something, you know, a bit of a caveman thing into it. Yeah. You know, I'm going to put myself in an absolutely impossible, you know, life or death situation in an artificial way. That's a sort of possibly a male instinct. I know this is, you know, I think we're among friends. I think we can kick these ideas around. Yeah. But
a starting point for discussion. I'm very interested to hear what people have to say about this, and if they agree or if they disagree, how they disagree. Because I think there's something in it. I'm just, you know, I'm always wary about generalization.
But on related possibly to that, inclusivity, you were tweeting about Black Lives Matter. I've seen you tweeting about, you know, if you're leading a ride, you should be very clear that, you know, anyone gay is welcome. You should be explicit that, you know, LGBT people are welcome in the ride, because you obviously won't be able to tell by looking at them. So you should be explicit, you know, and Black Lives Matter. And so you've got strong views on this. Perhaps you could speak a little bit to that and whether cycling has an opportunity to be more inclusive, and how that opportunity may be taken.
It definitely does. And there's good work happening, and more of it needs to happen. And I think one of my big feelings is it's on all of us. It shouldn't be just the minorities fighting for this. It's on all of us who are already in to do the work that we have to do, not to just say, come in, you're welcome, which we should be doing anyway, but also to look at all the ways that people might still not feel welcome. So back in the days when I used to turn up to rides and it was a bunch of tall old men, it was fine. They were always nice, you know. As I said, it wasn't the most comfortable atmosphere, but I didn't care because I wanted to ride a bike, and I thought, well, if no one likes me, I'll ride on my own, and I can do that anyway. I'm not here to make friends. If I make friends, great, obviously. I realise how antisocial I'm making my order. Nothing like that. I don't know why I'm on this strange groove. Having had those experiences, I know that it's not enough. Like, all of the men I've ever cycled with would have said, of course, we welcome anyone. Anyone is welcome here. But in practice, that's not always what it feels like. And even if you feel that you're welcome, you know, they might all be riding along. Actually, I'll use an example that's not about men. I went for a few rides a couple of years ago, somewhere when I lived somewhere, with a local group of women who got together to go mountain biking once a week. I thought, great, that sounds like fun. And when I got there, well, basically, I didn't go out with them very much, simply because, and it wasn't any bad thing, they were all mothers with children of a certain age, and that was all they talked about. And that's fine. But it just, there wasn't really, I didn't really fit in. So it was very good that that group existed. And I think they're probably still going and having a great time. And I didn't feel unwelcome. You know, they were great. We did have some fun. But ultimately, I wasn't part of that. And that actually leads me into a further point. I mean, I'm going to have about a million points to make on this, which is that we do need groups that are, for example, only for women of colour or only for gay people. Not all the time. We don't want to break the world up into smaller and smaller boxes. But sometimes it's really nice to be with people where you can just talk for hours about the one particular thing you all have in common and it not be boring or not feel like you're kind of forcing it on people or have people look at you funny or not even get it. Or on the other hand, you can, you know, ride around with all the other gays and know that you're not the gay one. It's fine, you know, it's no longer an issue because everyone's in the same boat. And that's really valuable. So one of the other sort of, I don't know, triggers for this, I guess, is that I'm gay, and over the last, well, since I came out, which is nearly 15 years ago, 20 years ago, because I'm quite old now, the world has changed wonderfully, like for me. Not for everyone. There's still a great deal of homophobia and homophobic hate crime in a lot of parts of the world, including our own. But my experience in the societies that I live in, it's wonderful now. It used to be something that people were uncomfortable with, a bit hostile to, certainly didn't want to talk about it. And the general feeling was it was fine, but just, you know, we don't want to
talk about it.
Yourself. Yeah, yeah. Now, I honestly can't believe it. It's actively celebrated. Everyone, even before the NHS thing, everyone's going around wearing rainbows. Loads of my straight friends now go to Pride just because they want to. I don't go to Pride, I hate crowds, but they do. And we did this thing a couple of months ago with a group called Pride Out, where we had, like, middle of June, we had a Pride ride. Everyone went out remotely in different parts of the country wearing rainbows, and we all just reported back on social media. And it was so wonderful. And one of the best things about it was that not all of them were gay. Some of them were straight people who had no particular personal stake in this. They just thought, this is cool. I want to support this. And I want to let people know that they're welcome. And honestly, it melts my heart. Yeah. And I realise, like, this is where we wanted to get to in some ways. There's more work to do. There always is. But this is the kind of thing I used to dream about when I was younger. And this gives me a little bit of a sense of what we now need to be doing for all the other people who are not yet fully welcome. It's never exactly the same approach. I don't think all of us going for a ride wearing a Black Lives Matter t-shirt is going to solve the problem, though we could give that a try. But it's having that experience myself has made me realize how hard it can be to be the only person. And for example, to be there on a ride when someone makes a gay joke and no one knows you're gay, you don't know if anyone else is gay, it's really uncomfortable, but you don't want to say anything because they might react the wrong way. And you know, other people are still going through that. And it's made me a lot more keen to, you know, make sure I am not the person making the awkward comment, and to make sure that I'm the one calling out the awkward comments when other people make them. You know, on the occasions where I've been in that situation, I have wished that one of the tall white men would say, mate, could you not?
Yeah.
Coming from him, it's great. Coming from me, I'm the yappy feminist. It's so much better if somebody else does the work for once. So that's my fairly rambling way of
explaining. No, it's so interesting. I mean, so you think in your lifetime it's changed dramatically, but what do you think if you look back a generation or two generations about the life of gay people just in society? It's like, it's come on.
Really? it's one of our success stories, I think. Although every time I think that, I realise more and more, it's quite a particular one. It is particular classes of people in particular areas. But still, in the lifetime of people alive, like, I know people who have gone from, you know, the time when it was illegal and you could be arrested to now where you can get married and your family come and celebrate you. I met a couple a few years ago they were married and they had been together since it was illegal for them to be gay. And to go through that in one lifetime, you know, the older people are, I can remember when it was different 20 years ago, people who can remember 30, 50 years ago, it's just, it's amazing how much has changed, which means we can do it. And it means that we should pay attention to all of the current civil rights movements and maybe learn some lessons and do what we can to help.
It's like you say, though, if you were black and you turned up at a cycling group and it was all white people wearing Black Lives Matter t-shirts, I mean, you may take that as, well, this is a great show of solidarity, but you may also feel a bit self-conscious about it. You may be a bit like, I don't necessarily want to talk about this. Do you know what I mean? I don't know. There's sort of.
I mean, I think you probably, I don't know.
You might think it was a bit unusual, mightn't you?
Whereas, I don't know, if it was a much more mixed group, it might be different.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
There's more and more groups, well, they've existed before, but they're now a lot more prominent. Like there's the Women of Colour Cycling Group.
Yes,
you are good from strength to strength. And there's the Black Cyclist Network. And I know the Black Cyclist Network is open to people from any background. I'm not sure about Women of Colour Cycling Group. I think that's only women of colour. But I can see exactly why it would just be more comfortable to occasionally just be with people who share this particular characteristic. So you can take a deep breath and relax and not be the black one for once.
Yes, exactly. Not have to talk about your, you know.
And, your, you know, not have to worry that any minute there's going to be some sort of microaggression or someone making a slightly off-colour comment and they mean well, so you should probably just take it, but actually it's made you feel uncomfortable.
Yes. I think there's going to be a lot of this. There's going to be a lot of this of well-meaning awkwardness.
We all need to do our best to not do that. And one of the ways to do that is just to listen. There's all of it's already there because people of colour have been talking about this for years and years and in fact generations. And if we're not sure what we need to do, just go and follow lots of people on Twitter and listen to the conversations they're having. That's a place to start. And then there are books you can read and there are things you can watch. There's probably all sorts of TED Talks and things. Everybody's going to make mistakes, but there's actually quite a lot of learning we can do just by immersing ourselves more in it. And I mean, nothing I'm saying here is original. I know that books by people of colour are booming at the moment because everyone suddenly wants to read them because it's going to help. And I think actually, you know, that's not the only thing we need to do, but it does, because I've read a lot of books by Jamaican women in the last few months. It's just sort of a thing I got into. And just to use that as an example, it's just made me way more interested in anything to do with, you know, the Jamaican experience and all
of that. Yeah.
And it's sort of, I'm trying to explain this. I don't know, the issues feel relevant to me, you know. It's no longer someone having to explain, no, but you know, you got that wrong. And I'm suddenly like, oh no, okay, this is, I'm losing my articulateness, but you know, you expand your perspective.
Totally.
You start
totally
to see things on as your own because you've spent, you know, 300 pages seeing the world through the eyes of someone else.
So that's
what you can do.
Yeah. Well, maybe before we close, we're not closing yet, but before we close, you should recommend a book or two, either cycling or something on the spot.
I could recommend loads. It's just picking one. How am I going to do that? I've got books all around me as usual. So
I recommend What Goes Around, because you've all read Where There's a Will, I'm imagining. I've said that many times, haven't I? Kim Harding. Now, she did send this question an hour ago. It's a very slack level of service here. Kim Harding, with all that spare time during lockdown, did you not think of writing another book?
Thank you,
obvious.
Kim. Kim is a he and not a she. And yes, an avid collector of books by women about cycling. So you just want another book for your bookshelf, don't you?
So did I say she? Did I say that?
I think you did, but
No, I've got male friends called Kim. Sorry, whatever. You could call it the Invisible Peloton, he says.
Well, maybe. I think at the moment very easygoing about the prospect of writing future books, because I will probably at some point. I like writing books. It's a good thing to be doing, but I don't have any immediate urge to write one. I don't currently have a thing to write about, and I feel quite lucky to be in the position of having a lot of other things I could do. So a lot of writers, I think, once they publish a book, I imagine there's this panic of, oh no, and now I need to think of another book to write, because that is how I'm going to make my living for the next few years. So, you know, the pressure to come up with an idea if you don't have one, and secure a publishing deal and all of that, and to hope the idea works. So I don't currently have an idea. I probably will in future. And I'm not very worried about that, because I have a lot of other things going on. What I'm very interested in at the moment is all the work that other people are doing. I mean, I'm reading so many books by other people at the moment, and thinking, there's so much I have to read before I can write anything else.
Can you say what the deal is with this book? Did you pitched it before you did the Transcontinental, or you wrote it and then you pitched it? And did they not sign you up to do another book afterwards? What's the kind of
So what happened with that one? Actually, I had the idea for it quite a long time ago. When I published the first book in 2016, I'd done one Transcontinental and not completed it, but I already knew I wanted to write about this for some reason. So I wrote the proposal when the first book came out, like publishing week, and sent it to my agent, and my editor at Faber read it, and they did the thing they do in publishing of saying, this is lovely, it's so good, you're so talented, just one or two things, which is great. It's a lovely way to get feedback. And in hindsight, there wasn't really very much in the proposal, because I'd barely done any racing, and a lot of it was speculative. It was saying, I'm going to go and do these things, I promise I'll write about them. So that kind of floundered for a bit. And then my editor from Profile ended up approaching me. So his name's James Spackman. He's a wonderful man, and has an imprint called Pursuit within Profile Books that only publishes cycling books. And he'd sort of, you know, he'd scoped me out, and we had a meeting, and he said, I absolutely want to publish this book. Just let me know when you're ready. And then I think we spent over a year with him kind of courting me patiently. I think he had an alert set up, because every month or so I'd get an email from him saying, just to let you know, I'm still really interested if you ever want to send me a proposal. And I would say, oh no, I don't think I think other people would do better. Here's a list of other people who could write that book for you, and all sorts of things.
You really did that. You knocked the publisher back.
Yeah, well, I had various sort of, you know, ups and downs and crises of confidence and lack of it. And eventually the idea just, it came together, I think, at a time when it was ready to come together. Mm. And I think these things, they can be rushed and forced, but I think they're better when you don't rush or force them. And I think, I don't know how James reacted when I finally sent him a proposal, but there may have been whoops.
David Hewitt. Well, he's cycled long distances with a tent and too much stuff on board, and he's been knackered after 8 hours in the saddle. How do you make the jump to 20 hours in the saddle and still managing to get up and go the next day?
Well, so partly carrying almost no kit. I think really reducing the weight helps, because there's just less to haul up the hills. So when I did the Transcon, I probably had maybe a couple of kilos of kit, and it really was just the bare minimum of tools and a spare pair of shorts and a waterproof and whatnot, a bivy bag. So that helps a bit. I think really the answer here is couriering helped with that, because I think it was a really, really good accidental training ground for ultra distance racing, simply because you have to get up and get on the bike and ride all day, every day, whether you want to or not, whether it's raining or not, whether you're in the mood or not, no matter if you have a headache or a sore knee or a hangover or anything like that, because it's your job and you've got to do it. And if you keep taking days off, you're not going to last long. So eventually you don't have the decision of, do I want to do this? Shall I do this? It's what you do. You go and do it. And of course, in the Transcon, I was riding for longer than I would have been riding as a courier. But I think the basic hurdle of you get up and you do this was quite helpful. It's just, you ride the bike, that's what you do, that's what you're made for, and you keep going. And any difficulties you encounter are just an obstacle that you overcome in the pursuit of riding the bike. So I guess it's more a mindset thing. But I mean, it's very hard, and there were long periods where I thought, why am I doing this? It's too hard, I'm very tired. I never claimed to be superhuman.
Can you remind us of the balance between riding and sleeping in the Transcontinental for you?
I aimed to sleep for 4 hours a night. That was what I figured out.
It was 4 hours, right.
Yeah, and then I wasn't riding for 20 hours a day. I was riding and running around Lidl and sitting in cafes and,
yeah,
you know, procrastinating and all the other things I did. But yeah, 4 hours sleep, and then spend as much of the rest of the time riding as I could force myself to. There's a saying that if you're not riding or eating or sleeping, you're wasting your time, and I tried to stick to that.
Well, I read this book a while ago. I've read bits of it the last couple of days as well. But you do stay in a hotel at one point, don't you?
Oh, I stayed in many hotels. I think it was maybe every 3-4 nights, right. Depending on where I was and what was available. I mean, sometimes it was a guest house or a hostel at one point. Yeah, there are people who do it in a much more hardcore way and just sleep out every night, never change their shorts, and I can't imagine how awful that must be. A lot of people were in hotels every night. That's actually quite a common way to do it. The interesting thing was that there were a few guys I leapfrogged with for a few days. You know, we'd see each other every few hours. So we're going at roughly the same pace, but they were sleeping in hotels and getting 6 hours kip, and I was sleeping in ditches and getting 4. So they were clearly riding faster than me, and perhaps that had something to do with their better quality of sleep. But I was happy. I like sleeping in fields.
Did you really sleep in a ditch? Not a roadside
ditch? No. Actually, well, I never slept in a ditch, because that'd be silly, because water collects. But I did stupidly one night sleep in at the very bottom of a quite steep river valley in France, having already noticed that there was quite a lot of temperature inversion going on, and spent the whole night too cold to sleep properly. You know the way you do when you camp?
Yeah, terrible.
I'm almost comfortable, though. I don't want to wake myself up by going to get more clothes on, so I just lay there not sleeping, and then got a chest infection from all the damp. So don't sleep in ditches or river valleys.
The thing that Emily has done, and I am guilty of this, is that we're hearing her experiences as anecdotes. But the extremity of these experiences is, I mean, it's not lost when you read the book. You're really feeling it, and it's very... I can't really describe how you write, but it's very evocative and very descriptive of your, you know, what's happened to your body, what's happened to your emotions. But then here we represent them as anecdotes. And it's funny you're sleeping nearly in a ditch. But I mean, we don't underestimate what it's built on. I mean, that's a process, isn't it? You're turning something that is a kind of, you know, a terrible experience, or, you know, a dramatic experience into something else.
That's actually a big part of how I get through it, though, in all sorts of ways. I mean, I've learned with all the years I've spent doing weird bike rides that often the worst rides are the ones that you remember the most fondly. I don't know how that works, but the good days all blend into one. It's hard to describe, you know, a good day on the bike I've had, but I've got some cracking bad rides I can tell you about, you know, days where everything went wrong and I felt awful and all this happened. So I've got to the stage where actually, when it's all going pear-shaped, I get through it by reminding myself, I'm going to really enjoy looking back on this. This is, you know, this is almost a good memory already.
That's good.
And it actually helps. And then on top of that, you know, getting to tell people about it is even better. Or sometimes I get through something knowing that this is going to be a really good blog post or chapter one day, and that helps as well.
Yeah, that's true. But you're not willing things to go wrong. You are a little bit. There's part of you that isn't unhappy when things go wrong, though, because that is
well That's not in exactly that way, but I remember the a few days into the TransCon, they got me saying this on film. I saw it in one of the videos. When I got to checkpoint two, I remember saying, I kind of want some stuff to go wrong because it's kind of broadly going well so far. I've had highs and lows, but you know, it's all right so far. Nothing awful has happened, but I know it's going to. So I kind of want it to get a move on because I'd much rather have the nightmare than be dreading it.
Oh yeah, that's true. To get into the midst of it. I don't know. This is a bit tangential, but I've been reading Harpo Marx's autobiography, Harpo Speaks, which unusually, the early chapters about his childhood ducking and diving in New York are tremendous. And then when he gets some money, he just writes chapters about, you know, playing croquet with his rich mates. It's absolutely terrible. Well, it's not terrible. He's very charming throughout. But like, we're pleased for him that his life has turned out smoothly, but we don't care. When he's really scrapping, it's absolutely tremendous. The stories are ridiculous, obviously. Anyway, that's by the by. Imagine he was on the bucket list.
Because one of the more complicated reasons I'm not currently writing another book is I prefer the periods where I'm scrapping, and where I'm doing something new and it's hard and I'm struggling and learning a lot and I'm not yet on top of it. Once you know what you're doing, it kind of, you know, it levels off. I like the excitement of the struggle and the climb. So writing another book, it's sort of diminishing returns because I know I can do it now and I know what sort of book I write. So there's less of a discovery, there's less of a learning curve. And that I think is partly why that's not what I'm doing at the moment.
Yes, yes, indeed.
The same thing again and again. There's too much else in the world for that.
Yeah. Do you think you will stumble into the next subject that you do and you'll suddenly realise, oh, this is my emotional shift that now must be documented?
Probably.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
So you can't predict what it would be, can you? Because you're going to stumble into it. So.
I know, but that's the fun thing.
My thanks to Emily Chappell for being such a tremendous guest. I hope you enjoyed that. More information on upcoming podcasts and Zoomcasts, and maybe even some live events at radiodayseventsdays.com. In the meantime, thanks for listening.